with you?
The last time that we're due to meet before Shavuos, for a week or so, and I thought it would be a good idea would be to pick up some loose ends of a subject that we've begun before. That's one of the most misunderstood subjects, and the most importantly misunderstood subjects there is, and that's the idea of tefillah, what's called the davening. In English, we call it prayer, but that's not what we mean. The word in English has got connotations of very non-Jewish activity. Davening, tefillah, is the highest meditation that there could be. Not only that, but it's a distinct obligation. Not only that, but your life depends on it. And not only that, but the existence and life of the world, the Jewish world and the world in general, depends on that. There are some authorities that say that if you don't daven properly, you don't know what it means, and you don't engage in activity with a full meditational power that you should, so the rest of the Jewish world can have a claim on you that you are bringing about damage to them, that you're responsible for damage that occurs to them, because you have it in your power to bring down what's called Shefa. That means to bring down from the spiritual world, to bring down power that causes certain effects in the world, prevents certain damage and causes certain beneficial things, and you're not doing that. And every Jew's tefillah is necessary, and you're not doing it. And therefore, some authorities say that if Jews live in a community and a Jew doesn't come to shul, that means there's a Jew who doesn't daven, stays home, he's called a Shochen Ra. Shochen Ra means a bad neighbor, but it means an evil neighbor. It means a maliciously evil neighbor. So the commentaries say, why is he called evil? He doesn't daven. He doesn't want to meditate. He doesn't want to get himself into that spiritual high. And why is he called a bad neighbor? But you can understand, the reason is he's called a bad neighbor because he's damaging you, because we need him. My tefillahs don't get through unless you put yours in. We don't affect the changes that we need to affect in the world unless each of us puts in that meditation, right? Because collectively we can generate a power that's much deeper than any of us can do individually. Let's try and understand, what is this meditational idea? What does it mean? Now, we're going to talk about some of the highest things that there are, so we have to stay together now. First of all, you have to understand the following thing. This is probably the least understood aspect of davening, is that it's directly linked to the mechanism that powers the cosmic structure. Directly linked, not vaguely linked, but directly linked in. So intimately linked into the cosmic structure that, again, if you don't put in that energy, things won't happen. That means it's not that you're asking for something that you want because you feel you want to ask, or because you're pouring your heart out in Tehillim, or whatever it is. It's not the idea. It's that idea also. But it's much, much more potent than that. It's locking into the system in such a way that you actually cause the system to move. Even though what's causing the whole system to move is Hashem's Ratzon, that means what Hashem wants, but he makes what he wants and what he does in the world subservient to your asking for it, to our asking for it. And that's a fascinating thing that people don't understand. The dismal truth is that in this generation it almost doesn't operate. Well, we'll have to see what that means. But in terms of what it should do, we're almost powerless. But the tragedy is that we're powerless because we don't understand. If we understood what that power of that meditation was and we put the energy in, the whole thing would come alive immediately, instantaneously. But because we don't actually understand, if you want to put it in crude terms, we don't believe that saying those words or putting your energy into that spiritual world is going to make a difference, so we don't put the energy in properly. And then it has no value. The Gemara says that if a person takes 3 steps back after the Shemoneh Esrei, right, he's been meditating in this position and he's supposed to have been davening, but actually he wasn't concentrating. Right? He took 3 steps back at the end and he takes 3 steps forwards immediately, which means he doesn't actually perceive that he's come down from a very high world. It says it's like a dog returning to his vomit. That's what the Gemara says. And the Gemara doesn't exaggerate and it doesn't seek out poetic or, you know, forceful phrases. Gemara means it literally. And just like a dog goes back and eats his vomit, that's what a person is doing. He spits out meaningless words, and it's worse than that, it's disgusting, because you spit out words that should have been the highest connection. If you want a crude motion, it's like a husband who's in a very intimate situation with his wife and he's talking to her, not even thinking about her at all, thinking about somebody else. Now, that's the element, that's the feeling of disgust that the spiritual world experiences when a person puts himself in that situation. And that's of course why it's so difficult. That's why it's almost impossible to concentrate just for more than a few seconds at a time. And that's why the Rambam and Paskins, and we have it clearly brought down in Halacha, that if you have concentration and you mean what you say, and just for the first of the 19 blessings, all 19 brokers in Shmoneh Esrei, if you mean what you're saying, just for the first one, you fulfilled your obligation. That's a pathetic thing to have. Imagine telling somebody that and get 1 out of 19. But 1 out of 19 is good enough. We'll regard you as having fulfilled your obligation. But the reason is it's so difficult to get right. And if you can just hold by what you're saying and really mean it and focus in and lock in at a minimal level just for one of them, that's considered already to have really made a difference. Somebody who can train himself after a week or 2 weeks to hold through the first one, and then he can have intention for the second one. He can actually feel the difference and he can feel the change. That's a remarkable thing. So we have a very, very hard job. We have to understand how powerful this idea is, how low we are in this area, why we don't feel response when we daven, because we're not really davening, and to understand it so powerfully that if a person puts his mind into it accurately and correctly, actually will feel the response. It's 100% guaranteed. If you know what you're doing, you actually experience the response in Tula. There are very few areas like that in the spiritual world, and you have to know this is one of them. In the spiritual world, if you put the effort in, the kedusha that results, the feeling, the sensation, the elevation that you get out of it, and the effect that happens in the world, they're very unusual, very few and far between areas where you get a genuine feeling. You can be misled by your intuition. Your intuition can tell you that you're actually having a high, but actually, very often we don't know whether it's a lower self speaking, or whether it actually is your higher self speaking. We're in a generation now where your intuition cannot be trusted. Right? You have to first wipe out totally all ego before you can trust your intuition. And that's very hard, and davening helps with that too. So let's try and understand the power of this area and how it works. Complicated area. One has to know from the beginning that even if one puts one's energy in correctly, sometimes the response is not what you expect. He was a very great leader. He had a very great mystical background also. One of his followers, one of his Talmidim, came to him one day and he said, "What's wrong with my tefillah? I'm davening, I've had so much trouble." This man had been through agony, and he was going through agony. "And I'm davening and davening, I'm asking Hashem for what I need, and he's not answering me." So the Rebbe said to him, "You are being answered." The answer is no. Mm-hmm. You understand? There's a way of davening that the answer will be yes also. But first, the only way to get there is to understand that if the answer is no, it doesn't make any difference to you. Right? It's an amazing paradox of killing of the ego that a person has to understand. Trying to get to grips with this. In the case of a certain contemporary Hasidic leader, who they say, this is the story, they say that a woman came to him whose son was dying. Boy had certain illness and he had only a very short time left in him. So the woman sat with the Rebbe and she cried and she said that she told him the story and she wanted the Rebbe to daven. So the Rebbe said to her the following thing: "If you knew that Hashem wanted your son, if you knew that Hashem wanted your son right now, that he wasn't going to live, and that was really what Hashem wanted, would you be able to give him up? Before we daven, if you knew that he had to die, that means that Hashem needs this. This is what's needed in the world, and that's what Hashem wants. Could you give him up?" So the woman sat for a long time agonizing over her emotions, and finally she said yes. He said, "Fine, now we can daven." And they davened together, and the boy lived, actually. Still alive. Understand, it's an amazing paradox that's involved. Let's try and take it apart together and understand. They're hard to express these things. The Gemara says this. Let's start in the following way. Gemara says, when Rebbe was dying, Rebbe Yehuda Nasi, not the greatest man of his generation, a man so great that the Gemara says clearly, openly, without any, in the section of the Gemara, it's not dealing with any mystical concepts, not on the surface. The Gemara says that when Rebbe died, after he died, every Friday afternoon he used to come home. That means to his house, in his body. He used to come home, and he used to enter the house. Before he died, the Gemara says, he said to his family that there should be a bed made, a table laid, and a candle lit every Friday afternoon. Before Erev Shabbos, Kiddush time. After he died, he used to come back. He used to walk into the house. He used to make Kiddush. And he used to be there in his body after he had died. So the Gemara says one day his maid in Rebbe's house was a very great woman. You'll see in a while. We learn amazing things from her in Gemara. This maid one day got a little upset with people outside and she said, "Be quiet, Rebbe's here." When Rebbe heard that people outside knew that he was around, he said, "He's not coming back." Because he didn't want to be an embarrassment to others who didn't do that. He didn't want to have any reflection. A certain reason he didn't come back again. That was the man we're talking about. And the Gemara mentions it totally even, the Gemara mentions it only to bring certain things that we learn from it, but not to tell you that it's in any way surprising that Rebbe should have the capacity to do that. This world and the next world are the same, made no difference to him. Yeah, it made no difference. Wearing a body, not wearing a body, putting the body back on after he'd taken it off, made no difference to him at all. The body, of course, was perfectly intact. You know that. You know that the great tzaddikim, that bodies do not decompose after death. So, that is Rebbe. Now, the way Rebbe died before this thing happened was as follows. A very, very interesting story. The Gemara says this. Rebbe was very sick. He was very sick. He had a certain kind of suffering that great people have. It says a certain kind of illness can affect people in a certain way. Doesn't matter. He was suffering very greatly. The Gemara says that actually it's a fascinating Gemara. It has a lot of medical application also. The Gemara says that when he was suffering very badly, the maid in the house, right, this great woman, perceived how great his suffering was, and it says that she davened that he should die. She davened that he should die. You have to understand that. And the whole base medrash of Revi, all the Talmidim who were davening that he should live, when they heard her say that, they all davened that he should die, and he died. To understand now. You know, the primacy of saving a life in Jewish thought. What does it mean that you can daven that someone can die? She says, it says in Halacha that if somebody is suffering very greatly, of course you may not make any action that causes the person to die, but to daven that someone should die when it's considered inevitable, and of course we're not in a position to make that judgment, but she was, and the suffering is very great. It says that she saw him take off his tefillin repeatedly. He had to keep taking off his tefillin to use the bathroom. So she understood he was suffering very greatly, and he must have been suffering enormously, because there's another place in the Gemara that it says that Rebbe suffered for 13 years very greatly, and he suffered so greatly that the fishermen on the Kinneret could hear his screams. That means out on the Galilee Kinneret, the Yama Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee, the fishermen could hear him screaming. So he must have been suffering enormously, and that was nothing compared to this, because then no one davened for him to die. In fact, he took those on, well, he didn't take them on voluntarily, but there were certain kind of sufferings that had a spiritual, certain spiritual effects resulted in the world. So this is what happened. He was suffering very greatly. She saw him taking off his tefillin repeatedly. He had to use the bathroom. And she davened. First she said, may it be the will of the higher forces that they... First she said this. Before she realized how badly he was suffering, her prayer was phrased like this. May it be the will of the lower forces to overcome the upper forces. What she meant was that the Talmidim and the Beis Medrash of Rebbe were davening that he should live. And in Shamayim they were causing him to die when they could see that he was dying. So she davened first that the lower ones should overcome the upper ones. That the lower ones should force the upper ones, bend them to their will. And if then, that means that it's in a person's power, and this is the first thing we have to understand this evening, for a person in the world to say that it should happen, that our will should overcome the spiritual will. That means in the world of truth, the world of MS, a certain force is coming down, we can overturn that. Quite literally. Now this wasn't an emotional outburst. This was something that actually kept him alive. And he lived. And while the Talmidim heard her say that, they davened for him. And as they all sat and davened, they said to him, he lived. Then when she saw how badly he was suffering, she changed the words around. She said, may it be the will of the higher ones to overcome the lower ones. When they heard that, they stopped davening and he died. Now the Gemara says a very amazing thing. While he was dying, they were davening. They were praying. And they issued a statement, the Talmidim, the Beis Medrash of Rebbe, they issued a statement as follows. Let anyone who says that Rebbe has died be pierced with a sword. Idoka b'cherem, that's what it says. Amazing thing. If anybody says that Rebbe has died, this is on the day that he was dying. If anyone says that Rebbe has died, he should be pierced with a sword. And they meant it literally, that was a gzera. That meant they issued a proclamation, right, that if anybody would say that he died, then he would be pierced with a sword. So the Rishonim all ask, what kind of a statement is that? I mean, what were they doing? What did they mean? Why was there such a... What was so bad about saying that he died? And the commentaries say, the Rishonim say, that what they meant was that if anybody said that Rebbe had died, even if he had died, he would be killed. You understand? That means like this. Let's say Rebbe's in some place where he's suffering and the people are dying. Some place in some other part of the land, that's Israel, somebody comes along and says, today Rebbe's died. Without knowing whether he has or hasn't. Even genuinely under the misapprehension that he has died. Even if Rebbe has died already and he's saying the truth, he deserves to be killed. In fact, then we will kill him. Why? Now, you know in Jewish law there's no way to kill somebody unless you're threatening someone else's life. So the question is, it means that if this person says Rebbe's died, he must be threatening the life of Rebbe. But the problem is, how does he threaten his life if he's died already? Are you with me? You don't need too much of a Gemara cop for this. Huh? Are you with me? I'm not going to enjoy the explanation unless you hear the problem. So, Neshtim HaKubetz is one of the great Rishonim, they answer as follows. It's a very, very amazing thing to understand. The reason is as follows. If Rebbe was dying, and they were potentially dying, and they were davening, they were keeping him alive. That's how I understand. The power of their tefillah, right, of that meditation, was so great that it could keep him alive. And therefore, if anyone would come along and say that Rebbe died, so they'd all stop davening. Because we have a din that you don't daven for somebody who's died already to come alive again. Not allowed to do that. We'll have to understand why in a moment. Therefore, they would stop davening that he should stay alive, and Rebbe would die, so they cost him his life. The greatest man of the generation, they needed him very badly. So therefore, if anybody said that he died and he caused them to stop davening and then he died, of course that person would be responsible for his death. So they didn't want anyone to say that. Should be very careful what they said. So they made such a proclamation. But the amazing part of the story is that why were they so anxious that someone shouldn't say it, even if he had died already? And that's unbelievable. And this is said in an even tone, absolutely straightforward halacha, right? Not, you won't find this in the mystical writings. This is said openly in the commentaries on the Gemara. Because listen to this. Had Rebbe died, and the people in the Beis Medrash of Rebbe didn't know that he died, and they davened, he'd definitely come alive again. There's no question about that. You hear that? If they davened, they're busy davening for Rebbe, and unknown to them, he's died. That wouldn't make any difference. The power of their tefillah, without any question, would definitely resurrect him. And therefore, if somebody came along and said that Rebbe's died, and now they stopped davening, even if he had died, so now the resurrection wouldn't take place anymore. And Itaka would stay dead. So for that, they deserve to be killed, because it's costing him his life. You hear that? It makes no difference whether he's living or dead. Absolutely no difference. Not at all. Not the slightest. The power of their tefillah is so powerful that it will give him life, whether he's alive makes no difference at all. Whether naturally in the physical world he's here or not, the tefillah will cause him to be alive again. What do you see from this Gemara? And then you see it in many places in the Gemara. You see that the power to resurrect the dead, that means not just to bring down Shefa to the world, not just to make it rain when it needs to rain, right? But to make someone alive whose body is not alive anymore, put that neshama back into the body, is absolutely within the realm of tefillah. That meditation is so powerful that you could connect to the source in such a way that the source would connect to you in such a way that that energy would flow back into the world, right? And it would reconnect with whatever in any target you force that only we have a din, and I don't know if we can go into this evening, that you're not allowed to daven for someone who is not alive anymore for certain reasons. Let's say you have to know what you're doing, let's put it that way. If you want a general rule, you're not allowed to do it. There are certain circumstances where it is allowed. The commentaries ask, why did Elisha do it? He came across a boy who had died, and he davened. He brought him back to life again. In fact, he did it twice, and he did it once. We have cases like that. David HaMelech davened for a child who was dying, and it says he was fasting and davening, and when the boy died, he stopped fasting, he called for food. Why didn't he daven that the child should come to life again? You have to know what you're doing. You have to know what you're doing. In the case of Rebbe, it wasn't appropriate. In David HaMelech's case, it was. But what we want, and we'll have to discuss that another time, but what we want from this evening is to understand that the koyach of this energy, the power of this energy is unlimited. That's what you have to understand. And in many, many cases in the Gemara, never mind in generations when there were prophets around, there are many cases of ordinary people. I mean, in our terms, they're certainly not ordinary. But in terms of the Gemara's day, people reached a level where they could do anything through the power of tefillah. Literally, miraculous events. Turn nature upside down, inside out, through the power of their tefillah. And there are many, many examples. The classical one that springs to mind to talk about the resurrection, just give you one more example. The Gemara says that Rebbe himself, when he was a very old man, prior to this story, used to learn together, used to study with a Roman Caesar, Antoninus. Antoninus in English is called Marcus Aurelius. In fact, he wrote many things. You can read today the writings of Marcus Aurelius. It brings down things that he learned from the great Jewish leader. It doesn't say that. Antoninus was his name. He used to come and visit Rebbe, and he used to visit him secretly. The Gemara says he used to come through a certain tunnel, because he didn't want to be seen to visit, visiting a Jew who was the leader of the oppressed people. And it says he used to do the following thing. The Roman used to walk in through this tunnel, secret tunnel that led to Rebbe's inner chamber. He used to take two slaves with him for an escort. When he used to arrive at Rebbe's room, he used to kill the one. And when he arrived back at his palace, he killed the other. Not any evidence. The king doesn't go alone. He goes with an escort. He used to kill him. So he did. Slaves were expendable in Rome. So the Gemara says this. One night he came to see Rebbe, and as he entered, he killed the slave, left him dead outside the door. And as he walked in to see Rebbe, he found Rebbe was not alone, but he was together with one of his youngest Talmidim, one of the smallest, one of the beginners in his Beis Medrash. One of the beginners in Rebbe's Beis Medrash. So Marcus Aurelius, Antoninus, got very upset, and he said, I told you, I never want to see you when you're with somebody else. I want to be seen alone. So Rebbe tried to placate him, and he said, Leis dein barinish. He's not human. Don't worry, he's not human. But Antoninus wasn't put off by that. and he had to get rid of him. So he said to him, do me a favor. He said to the Talmud, go and bring in, call in my slave. Go ask my slave to come in here. He thought that would take him quite some time. Right? He wanted to get him out of the room. So he said to him, go outside, you'll find my slave. Just kindly ask him to step in. That's what he said. So the Talmud walked outside and he found the slave dead. So the Gemara says he had a dilemma, because the order of a king has to be obeyed. In Jewish law, even a non-Jewish king, it has to be respected. And he had to honor the order of the king and he had to do what he said. On the other hand, to schlep in a corpse, he felt, would not be fitting the covert of the melech. They didn't know what to do. So the Gemara says he was put in a dilemma. So boy rachmei v'achyei. He asked for what's called rachamim, which is a certain connection with the source. We'll have to discuss it. But it means he davened and he brought him back to life and he brought him in. So when Antoninus saw him, he wasn't impressed at all. He said to Rebbe, I know that the least in your base medrash can do that. The least of your students can do that. Doesn't bother me at all. Then he wasn't at all impressed. And there are many such stories in the Gemara of what tefillah, that amazing power, can do. Okay? So it's a separate discussion why we don't use it in that area. And we actually, the Mephoshim say that when you daven for the resurrection, every morning, every day, in Shmoneh Esrei, three times a day, the second bracha of Shmoneh Esrei is Mechaye Amazing. Actually, we are davening. That's a bracha that goes on the resurrection. Mephoshim say you should actually mean waking up in the morning. That's what you should focus on. You should actually mean that. You shouldn't mean the other thing. That's another discussion why. What have we learned so far? We've learned the idea that the koyach of tefillah, the power of this connection, is absolutely unlimited. It's got nothing to do with a natural result or an unnatural result. Whether the result looks natural, like a rain falls when it should fall. So it might have been happening anyway. How do you know you affected that? Or whether it's unnatural, like bringing someone who's not alive back to life again, makes absolutely no difference. And it's a promise. It's a promise. It's not that you have to be lucky or very great. It's a promise. The forces are set up in such a way, if you bring them down, they operate. If you don't bring them down, they don't. Try and understand. The way the mystical writings put it is something like this. They note this from the fact, from the following fact. It says that all davening that we do, to understand this deeply now, all davening that we do operates through the Beis HaMikdash. That means if a person puts that energy, if he can meditate correctly and get himself transcendent, then what happens is he makes a connection between him and the Beis HaMikdash, the temple in Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, and from there the forces are transmitted into the inner world, and from there comes out the power. But it has to be done that way. And by the way, in Halacha, you know we have that din. In Halacha, what happens is you have to face Jerusalem. You have to face Yerushalayim. It doesn't make any difference where you're facing. It means spiritually, you follow. It does make a difference in Halacha, because when you face the body that way, you energize, you alive and put energy into those channels, and that's what you have to do. If you don't know which way is north, if you live here, then you can face in any direction and just do it inwardly, it says. But initially, you have to focus that way. You'll notice that many shuls in South Africa, by the way, are built in the wrong direction. You'll notice that many of them face east, because they are following Halacha that was written in the Northern Hemisphere, where Israel is east. Actually, many shuls actually have to turn away, because you have to face north. You have to face Yerushalayim. Be that as it may, you have to face through there. So the first thing to understand is, what's tefillah got to do with that? The spiritual world isn't located in a place on earth. Why do you have to focus through that energy, through that place? Secondly, they connected to the fact, and this is more difficult to understand, that what was unique about the Beis HaMikdash was the fact that 10 constant miracles appeared over there. There are 10 miracles that happened in the Beis HaMikdash that made it unusual. Right? All of them are connected to life energy in some way. Not easy to go through all of them. It says that no woman ever aborted, no woman ever miscarried from what went on there. Now there were such powerful energies over there. The smell of what was, there was a certain smell in there which was so high that if a woman smelt it, and certain a pregnant woman smelt it, it was possible for her to miscarry. That never happened. In fact, it should have happened. It never happened. That was one thing. The Kohen Gadol, the highest, the priest, on the day that he was meant to enter the Kodesh Kodashim, he never had a personal accident that made him impure. Also a loss of life energy. And it goes through 10 different things that all represent life force. You have to understand what all these things mean, but all these life energies were so potent that they were perfect over there. So what do we understand? Following thing. It means that davening has to go through a place, right? Again, we're speaking in the lower world. We have to understand this inwardly. Davening, that means the power of tefillah, is an energy that you put out that has to flow through that dimension. A dimension which is a dimension of miracle, that when nice happens. Now, There are two things that happen in the Beis HaMikdash that we have to understand carefully. One is the fact that it's the place of meeting of male and female. Right? That means the spiritual world and the physical world. Hashem puts his energy, connects with the physical world at that place. Right? That means it is the place of connection. That's what it is. That's why it says it's the place of beauty, because beauty is always where harmony occurs, where opposites meet and harmonize. That's why it's a place of beauty. That's why it says that the male and female zones meet there. It says the place, the Shmaya Ba'aran Nashki Adadi, where heaven and earth kiss, it says. It's not being poetic, it means literally. It's where the male dimension of the spiritual world meets the female dimension of the practical real world, this world, and the two produce something together. That's what it's very subtly and beautifully saying. That's what the Beis HaMikdash is. We pointed out before that one application of this idea is that the Midrash says that in the end of days, the Yishmael nations, the Arab nations, will build a holy site where the temple should be. And the Gemara says it's because their overriding negative characteristic is immorality. You hear that? Not out of political motivation, but because what's driving them in that zone is immorality. What's immorality? Forcing yourself in between husband and wife. That's what it means. So they put themselves there where we meet Hashem. That's the ultimate marriage in the world. That's the place where we and Hashem meet each other in the most intimate way. Right? That's why it says the two kruvim, where Hashem spoke with male and female, and they were embracing each other. That's what it means. It's a place of meeting, always in the hidden inner zone. That's what they've done. You understand this idea? Now, tefillah has to go through there. So what we have to understand is this, that when you daven, you go through a dimension that's the connection between physical and spiritual. That's exactly what davening is. Makes a lot of sense. Since the effort of that meditation is to raise yourself, take the physical vessel that you're in, use that as a vehicle to thrust up the spiritual being to such a high point that it almost snaps out. So you've made the connection, you've reached the source of connection between where the higher world meets the lower world. So it has to go through the Beis HaMikdash, which is a place where the two worlds meet. But what has to be understood more than that is that it goes through a place where miracles are normal. A place where the miraculous is every day. And that has to be understood. Are you with me? Not even one? Jewish women have always understood this more than Jewish men. It says that the women, Jewish women, used to, it wasn't a Jewish mother, didn't have a tear-soaked copy of Tehillim. Now it was soaked with the tears that she poured her heart out over in order to achieve what had to be achieved in the world. It wasn't an emotional, sentimental act. It was something that actually caused her family and her reality in the world to be what it was. It's always because women understand the point of connection more than men do. So the mystical sources say something like this. The reason that davening goes through a dimension of the miraculous is because a prayer is a miracle. And that's what we have to try and understand. Not easy at all. The concept of putting yourself into a world where your request, right, the form of our davening, is not a passive meditation. Right? In Eastern thinking, meditation is being able to negate the physical dimension. Right? That means it takes you to the border where a person can snap out of physical existence. In Torah, we understand that's only the prerequisite, that's just the beginning. Right? There's a reason for that, by the way, and that's because the non-Jewish nations, the non-Jewish sources of spirituality, have a great wisdom in being able to control the physical dimension, and they know how to raise, to make it, to disconnect. The Jewish element here, and that's why non-Jewish spiritual systems will never fulfill a Jewish neshama. That means they'll always burn out. Jewish neshama will always be let down. The only exception is a Jew who puts himself into a spiritual system and makes money from it. That will have an ongoing thing because he actually has a physical need. But if he puts himself in for fulfillment spiritually, he definitely will burn out in the end. That's what it says clearly in all the sources. Not because those systems are invalid. Not because they're invalid. They have contained great wisdom. But because he has a different spiritual source, and it's tuned differently. The Jewish neshama, powerful Jewish neshama, is tuned to being able to make that connection in a completely different way. It's a completely different dimension of connection. And therefore, our meditation is a completely different idea. It's making that connection, but not to snap out. It's making that connection to bring the lower world up. Right? Which is what we call miracle. That's called a nes. When the physical world changes because of the connection to the source. Not gets left behind. That's not what we're trying to do. We don't try and snap out and leave the physical behind. That's an easy kind of meditation. To do that, you can have a meditation where a person becomes completely blank. Right? That is a valid source of meditational effort. That's not what davening is. In the Eastern writings, if you're not here to advertise Eastern thinking, that's not our purpose at all here. Just the tragedy is that most of us are more familiar with that than what we should be familiar with. But if you read there, you'll see that the ultimate experience is one of blending in with the cosmic structure. That means an out concept of davening is not that. That might be relaxing. Might be a relaxation. But meditation is very hard work. When you snap into that level, that's a connection. Then what you have to do is draw the energy of the physical up into the spiritual, and the energy of the spiritual down into the physical. The physical has to change. That's what has to happen. Now, that's what we mean by tefillah being a miracle. If you want to put it in more mundane terms, now the Bala Musa expressed it something like this. If you're not given too much to the mystical side, then look at it more carefully this way. When you daven, you're asking that something should happen, okay, which wouldn't have happened otherwise. Which means when it happens, that's nothing short of a miracle. That means Hashem wasn't going to do this thing. Some of these elements we've discussed before, trying to understand them at this level. What are you doing when you stand in front of Hashem and you daven? I'm not talking about the meditational level. That's just a vehicle. You have to get up to that point of clarity in the mind, in the intellect. And you have to get up to that point of clarity where the ego completely stilled. That's the prerequisite, but that's when you begin. You got to do that before you start davening. Once you've perfected that, once you can meditate perfectly, and you can get up to a level where the ego is completely still, you've got no desires of your own at all, you've got total and absolute clarity, total objectivity, that's when you start davening. It says quite clearly that the early Hasidim, they used to spend an hour before they davened, and an hour after they davened, going up into the meditational zone and an hour to come down. But what they did when they got into that zone was what we call davening. That means living in the connection. Meditation without that is a bit like a marriage where the couple explore, they get to know each other more and more, and they never produce children. That's not what it's all about. The idea is to use that zone to carry the Kedusha into that zone so that energy comes down and things change. Now that's miraculous. So let's try and understand this. Let's take it apart. This is what happens. Person gets up into that zone. That's the first step. While you schlep up all your negias with you, if you take all your vested interests with you, you can't ask Hashem. What a chutzpah to stand in front of Hashem with all your vested interests and tell him you want this and this and this and this. Why do you want these things? Because you want them. First of all, expect him to listen to that. And secondly, what a chutzpah. You with me? That's not the idea of davening. No one, the spiritual world is not going to respond to that. You have to be so pure when you get up there that the negias, all vested interests, completely don't exist. Not only the vested interests mustn't exist, but all the mystical writings say that even the tools that you're using have to be purified. If you have a mouth, now, davening has to be said with a mouth, you know that? You have to say it with your lips, loud enough for yourself to hear at least. No louder than that. But you have to actually bring it out into the world, right, with that particular organ. If you think about what we said about the kissing before, understand also very deep secrets. But that's what you have to do. So when you get up to that zone, it says that if your mouth is contaminated, if you've used it for things that are not a connection of truth in the world, so then your tefillah is not going to be heard. Because you're using a tool that's been sullied. You follow? There's no bigger chutzpah than that. You take something that they gave you for a gift, you perverted this through the opposite use, now you want them to respond, you follow, using a tool that you've twisted and broken through using for what you shouldn't have. I don't know if you're aware, but that's why, if you look in the Siddur at the end of Shemoneh Esrei, there's a remarkable prayer. Are you aware of that? Elokai Nitzel L'Sheni Mira. When you get to the end of Shemoneh Esrei, it's a remarkable thing, I don't know if you've ever thought about it. You finish the Shemoneh Esrei, you speak to Hashem, three brachas that take you up into that zone specially, then there's 13 where you actually speak and bring down the 13 changes that are needed, and then the three of them at the end where you seal it up and close it off. After that, instead of stepping back, you launch into a whole paragraph about Elokai Nitzel L'Sheni Mira, Hashem, guard my lips, my tongue from guile, from deceit, right? And my lips from deceitfulness, lying, whatever. And you launch into this whole thing about how Hashem should help you. What's that doing at the end of Shemoneh Esrei? So the Mefarshim are very clear. The reason you do that is this. You've got to speak to Hashem. The only tool you have is your tool of expression. So you try to put that into use. But you've just been using that for things that are the opposite of connection. You've been using those instead of... Mystical sources say that just like the mouth is an organ of connection in kissing, it's an organ of connection of minds. Because when you want to experience what's in somebody else's mind, what happens is it expresses it with the mouth. So it shares the intimate side, right, of... It's very hard to talk about these things. In the deeper writings it says that the mouth is, in the higher world, what the system that produces children is in the lower world. Just that it's in a more refined dimension because it's closer to the spiritual source. In the body, that level is much less articulate, but it produces a child in the world. At the higher level,
it's much more articulate, because what's transmitted is a spiritual being. And that's why when you make a student, if you give Ra, if you teach somebody Torah, so he's regarded as your child. Because instead of giving him a body in the world, which is what the lower level does, the sixth of 7 points in the higher world puts his mind into the world, puts his spiritual being into effect in the world. So that's actually called a student, and that's why in some ways a Talmid of his Rebbe, a student of his teacher, has more responsibility to his teacher than a son does to his father in some ways. Because the Gemara says the father put his physical being into the world, but his Rebbe put his spiritual being into the world. There's a closer connection. So here you're taking this organ of connection, of giving birth in the world, giving birth at a higher level than giving birth to a body, and you've used that to make non-connection. What is non-connection? If you tell a lie, if you say a lie in the world, what's wrong with telling a lie? So the mystical writings say that what's wrong with telling a lie is that the purpose of communication is that I take my mouth and I share perfectly what's in me with what's in you. So that what you see on the outside, formed by my mouth, is a perfect reflection of what's inside. But a lie, and that's exactly beauty. That's what's called beauty in the world, the outside like the inside. That's what trust is, that's what emes is, that's what beauty is. But if I take the outside and I say something that's not on the inside, so I break down the world. I make the revelation not be parallel to what the core is. That's the ultimate evil in the world. Of course, that's what this generation is doing with the world. Instead of seeing it as a manifestation of the spiritual core, they take it at face value. That's the ultimate lie, that's the ultimate checker. Taking a human body, I presume you're with me, taking a human body, and instead of relating to someone, let's say a woman, man relates to a woman, instead of using the body as a vehicle that carries her personality and her spiritual essence into the relationship, he takes the body and relates to the body. So if you have a generation like this one, and they strip it naked and pin it up, and they get stuck into the physical outer trappings of reality instead of using it as a vehicle for that, the greatest lie there could be in the world. But the whole point of revelation in the world is to reveal what's inward. So you've taken this means of expressing the inward reality in the outer world, and you've used it to break down communication. You've used it to break down the connection. Now you want to go and daven? You want to take this mouth that you've used to break down the connection between the core and the revelation, and you want to bring down a connection? You follow the problem. That's the ultimate chutzpah. You spoke Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara, you said something about somebody that's hurtful in the world, and it puts out a vibe into the world that kills. That's what you did with this system. Now you stand in front of Hashem, and you want Hashem to bring down a connection that brings life into the world, but you twisted, you perverted the kli. The tool that you're using, you follow, the tool's not sharp anymore. You blunted and damaged the snap, the tool. Are you with me? And that's why when you end Shemon Israel, you finish by saying, listen Hashem, I know it's hopeless. I know it's hopeless. I'm speaking to you with a mouth that I've soiled. I've soiled it in exactly the way that prevents it from operating the way I'm trying to operate. So you finish off with this pathetic plea that from now on you should have a little help. And even that you have to say with a mouth. That's how pathetic you should feel. That even that request that he should look after is the only thing you say in the singular. It's the only thing you say that's for me. The rest you say for all of us together, and you hope to get in on the coattails of Jewish history. You hope to get in on the merit of who our great forefathers were. But this, you have to speak for yourself. That's your problem. So you say, Hashem, listen, not only have I damaged this tool, and so I don't expect you to listen to what I've said, but I want you to fix up the problem for me. Help me with the problem. And I know that I'm asking you this very request with the same sullied and soiled tool that I started with the problem in the first place. What else can I do? And that's what you do. And that's why when you finish that tefillah, you put your name in. But you're aware of that. When you get to the end of that, the Lokan and Silver showing right, you put your name in. You should say the pasuk, the verse from Tanakh that corresponds to your name. I'm sure you're aware. I'll say for those who aren't, that every Jewish name, every Hebrew name, we're not talking about your English name, but we're talking about your real name. The Torah connection to your neshama. That name, which is an expression of your essence, right? That name is a parallel to a certain verse in Tanakh. Right? And you should look at that. The pasuk in Tanakh starts with the same letter that your name starts with, and it ends with the same letter that your name ends with. And most people who come across their pasuk are struck by the depth of power that that expresses about their own personality. Even though many names might be connected with the same pasuk, it's remarkable to see people's reactions when they see what the pasuk actually says that deals with their particular name. It's an amazing thing. So what you do is when you get into that stage, you try and slip your name in. Of course, what the meaning of it is spiritually is that if you think about it carefully, how do you begin Shmoneh Esrei? You speak to Elokei Abraham, Elokei Yitzchak, and Elokei Yaakov. You speak to the God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob. Right? As we've mentioned before, that's the ultimate name dropping. That's why you do it. Because when you mention those names in the spiritual world, they listen. Right? If you would get up there and say, Hashem, I've got something to say. So they don't listen to you in the spiritual world. Right? You have to be very, very powerful to make the connection. And you need all kinds of help. And that's why we have a din, you should daven with a minyan. If you daven on your own, it's very, very hard to get through. The mystical writings all say that unless you speak in Hebrew, which is a direct access channel, so then it's very hard. It goes through intermediate forces that make it very difficult. If you daven with a minyan, then you can speak even in English. And that's, by the way, why we say Kaddish in Aramaic, which is not Hebrew. To show that when the power of a minyan is together, 10 people are together, the energy that's generated is such that you can slip in with that energy, even not in the... So, that's why a person should at least learn Shema by heart. He should learn at least a few minimal things in Hebrew by heart, even if he doesn't familiar with the language. So what happens is, you start with those names that provide the connection. Right? Because those people gave themselves entirely to Hashem. And the world was built on what they did. So you mention their names. After you've made the channel, and then you put in all the things that we need and that we want and what we're trying to build spiritually as a people, as we do it in the plural, you finish off the last thing you say, you quietly and surreptitiously you slip in your pasuk. What you want to do is you want to bring that energy all the way down to you. That I'm the tail end of this thing. That's what you're saying. You're saying, Hashem, these people are the people who made the ultimate connection. They brought life to the world. And on their merit, I'm davening to you. And then when you finish, before you sign off, at the very end, so you put in your pasuk, it should connect to you, you also want to get in there. And you've got a hope of getting in because you connect yourself to that great history that's gone before us. That's the idea. So what do we see? The vessel has to be pure. The mouth that you use has to be pure. If you don't speak anything negative at all, you guard very carefully what you say. You don't speak any word that's unnecessary, even if it's not bad. So then you've energized that tool. But then it's a much harder job. You think that's hard, not to ever say an unnecessary word, and not to say anything that's in any way negative. But then you have to energize the spiritual domain. While it's full of, while it's turbid, while it can't be, while it's not transparent, so you can't take it up there. That has to be clarified. When a person does all that and you get up there, then what happens is you make a connection which brings down what we call nais, or miracle. The reason why you can do it, true, you have to get to that level, right? And of course, each one has to do it in proportion to what his ability is, right? You draw down that energy in proportion to the effort that you make. It's not a hopeless job. We're talking about people who are able to put energy in that brought a person back to life, but none of us could do that. Actually, we could do it if we... The Mephoshim are quite clear that if you knew that it could be done and you did it, it definitely would happen. Definitely, there's no question about it. The only thing is you don't actually believe that it will happen. So you don't put your energy in, that's what they say. That's all, that's the only problem. If you really knew that it could be, if you were connected to Jewish history in such a way that you knew that it would happen, there'd be no limit to whatever you put in. Doesn't matter. Whatever you ask, nothing stands in the way of Rotzon, which means the inner core of desire. If you put it in correctly, knowingly, but of course this generation, if somebody's not alive anymore, there's not even a question whether he could be brought back to life. If somebody's very sick, so we already regard it as a foregone conclusion. And if somebody's not that sick, but they're on the way to being that sick, we already regard it as a foregone conclusion. And we just vomit out a few words, just to be Yotzei Achiyuv. But actually we don't mean it. But if a person will put in the meaning that he really means it, and he knows that this will make a difference, it will definitely make that difference. Definitely. So let's try and see the next step. Now the mechanism of why this is described as being miraculous is for the following reason. This is what's hard to understand. You have a situation where a person is speaking to Hashem, which means that the nature of the tefillah, this is what we have to understand carefully. The wording of the tefillah is request. It's not a passive meditation. It's not a repeating of something that takes a person to another zone. It's actually phrasing and formulating a request. Hashem, I want this and this and this. We say it in the plural, but it could be a tefillah in the singular also. I want wisdom. The first thing you daven for in Shemoneh Esrei is Das. Das, inner wisdom, higher wisdom. Connection to the source, that kind of wisdom. Wisdom that's intuitive, that you know because you know it. That's what you ask for. Without that, you're nothing. That's what comes first. Without that deeper knowledge, right, you're nothing. You only know things because they can be proved in arithmetic. That's not called knowing anything. A machine can do that. You have to have real inner knowledge. So that's what you start with. And then you daven for this and for this and for this and for many other various spiritual lights that can be switched on, that can energize various aspects of your life or our life in general. The problem is this. When you're standing there and asking Hashem for something, the concept is that He's only going to give it because you're asking. Which means without you asking, He wasn't going to give it. That means that the world is set up now in such a way that if you don't say this thing, it won't happen. That means you actually making it happen. Let's understand this carefully. There's a problem. Okay? The problem is, we understand that Hashem knows what you're thinking. And He knows what's good for you. And He's good. It means He's definitely only going to do what's good for you. Well, we've tackled this angle in various ways before. So therefore, what difference is it going to make? The Hasidim, the great Hasidic thinkers, ask this question explicitly. What difference are you going to make by asking? A loving father who loves his child and wants the best for his child, he's going to give the child the best for him, even if the child doesn't ask. Definitely. And if the thing's bad for the child, surely he's not going to give it to him, even if the child does ask. So, absolutely not. The touch is that you didn't have it coming. You weren't going to get that thing. But it's asking for it that makes it happen. Which means Hashem wants to give that thing to you, but he limits himself, he holds himself back, he's not going to give it until you ask for it. Why? Why? Because you operate the world. You operate the world, not him. Huh? You operate the world. That means he operates the world, but you bring his energy in. We discussed this under the concept of the impossibility of ordeals. Right? If you refer back to that discussion, understand much more about this. So we have the following amazing paradox. Hashem sets up the world in such a way that he has a certain shefa, a certain energy that he wants to come down, but he cannot give it unless you want it. No matter how much it's good for you, and how much he wants to give it to you, but unless you want it, it's not good for you. And therefore, he requires that you bring it in. Right? The concept, if you want to put it into crude terms, would be like a man and a woman relating. If the man would relate to the woman deeply when she doesn't want, that's not love. That's not a relationship. That's what the mystics say, that the female side of the world sends up a certain kind of water. We can't, certainly not at the tape recorder, let's go into this discussion here. But there's a certain thing that gets sent up anyway, let's call it that for the present time. And that brings down a certain response from the male world. And if you have any sense about the world at all, you understand these things. Not difficult. But only if the lower world sends up the request, only if the female desire is put out first, does the male desire able to respond. Right? If it's not done that way, it's not called love. It's not called a relationship. But nothing at all. It's a most painful experience. And therefore, the world set up in exactly that way. Actually, in the mystical writings, it says that the male dimension comes first. It does put in the original energy. But let's not go into that now. The level at which we function here is that once the system's set up, there has to be a desire, and the desire has to be so strong that it couldn't survive without the result. Then when the connection is made, it's a life connection. That's what it has to be. That means a person has to raise himself to the level where he feels like a woman who couldn't live without this love. Or a child who couldn't live without the love of a parent, but who wouldn't live without it. Well, that's how you have to feel. That means you have to bring it down in such a way that it's your life. If you bring it down because it's an extra cherry on the top that you want, that's not going to do it. That's what you have to do. You have to bring yourself up to a level of clarity where there's no ego, and where the emptiness of ego becomes desire that is so strong that you couldn't live without it, and the desire is not for you. The desire is for him. And that's what love is really. You ever think about that? The female aspect of love, which is desire, right, actually should be the most sordid thing in the world because it's personal. I want because I want, but that's not what love is. I want because I want because I want you. And I want you to have. That's what it means. And that's why the Nefesh HaChaim says that when you ask for all the things that you need, you actually want them for Hashem. That's what you mean. You hear that? When you ask for wisdom, what you mean is, Hashem, I want wisdom, or I want the physical things that I need in life, but I don't want them for you. Right? Because my desire has become your desire. I only want what you want. If I want it for me, as opposed to you, what a chutzpah. What a chutzpah. I want you to give me this so I can run off and use it for what I want and forget about you. But of course that's not going to have any results, and of course it's futile, and it's a terrible chutzpah. That's not what you mean. You mean, Hashem, I want these things because I really want them. For myself, I don't want anything. That's what the Rebbe meant when he said to the woman, could you give your son up? When she said she could give her son up, it made no difference to her, then she could really ask for him. That's what it means. That's what you mean. When Hashem, I don't want anything for me. Now that I understand that, I want this so badly that I can't even put it into words. Can't even begin to express how badly I want this. But I only want it for you. Well, that's called being alive. Well, that's the ultimate spiritual paradox, that you're only really alive to the extent that you're filled with reality, but not with you. The more the ego shines through, so the more divorced you are from reality. The more you think you're something, of course the lower self feels very good, because you feel, now you really feel something. But of course you're cutting yourself off from reality. Yeah? That's what it is. And that's why we understand that raising oneself to that level when one actually brings in that which wouldn't have been otherwise, in order to, first of all it happens, it wouldn't have been otherwise, by asking for it you make it happen. But not only that, to do it, you have to change yourself completely. You have to change yourself so radically that you aren't there anymore. You have to first kill who you are, wipe it out, right? Want only what's valid from the higher reality, but want that badly with every fiber of who you are, put all the lower self, all the lower sense of desire into that for the right reason, translate all that physicality up into spiritual reality, and then it definitely will happen.
Tagore says the following thing. Again, these are things that when you put them into words, they're so clumsy, the words are not even inadequate, they're just hopeless, the words. But somebody who knows what love is, understands what a relationship is, connection is, what marriage is, then these things hardly need to be spoken out at all. But it's the only way you can understand them. The Gemara says this in Brachos. The Gemara says that Hashem davens. You hear that? Hashem, God, davens, he prays. So it says quite clearly. So the question is, the first question is, who does he daven to? Right, that's what's bothering you, right? Who does he daven to? What does he say? Well, what does he ask for? Because it says he davens, he asks for something. He asks. You know, we have a concept that the physical world is only a reflection of the spiritual world. It says that we wear tefillin. In our tefillin, it says certain praises of Hashem. It says he wears tefillin. And in his tefillin, it says praises of us, of his people, of his bride. That's what it says. We do mitzvahs, he does mitzvahs. Exactly the same thing, of course, he does it. He's the cause. We're the reflection. But we exact parallel. It says he davens. What's his davening? What's his tefillah? Listen to this. These are the words of Hashem's tefillah. Amazing thing. This is the place in the Gemara where it talks about Hashem doing all the mitzvahs that we do. When it gets to davening, it says this. Hashem prays. He davens. What does he say? He says this. Yehi rotzon milfonai. May it be my will. You hear this? Our davening is Yehi rotzon milfonecha. May it be your will, Hashem, that this and this and this should be brought down to the world. Hashem davens like this. Yehi rotzon milfonai. May it be my will. She'okum mikisei adin. That I should arise from the seat of judgment, and I should sit on the seat of kindness. That's his tefillah. What does that mean? So with a little of what we've said this evening, this idea is not so difficult. The concept is this. Davening doesn't mean asking somebody else for something that you want. That's not what it means. Again, the whole idea of davening means going to the root of who you are and changing who you are. That's what it means. That means all my desires, which are what I am, are now changed. They're not my desires. They're just as strong as before. They're much stronger than they were before. But they're only that I translate them, which is what love is. I want what you want for you, not for me. That's what love is. So you get up to the point where you take all your desires and you change them. You wipe out all your desires and you make your desires Hashem's, which is exactly what it says. I say Ritzon Charetzono. Make your will His will. That's what it means. Now you could really want, and very powerfully, and the desire then is much stronger than when it is only for the limited physical being. Now what you want is that the power of the spiritual world should fill you, and you should be one with that. So you want with all the power of the spiritual world now. That's what it is. So what you're doing when you daven is you're changing who you are. You're changing your rotzon. And that's what Hashem does when He davens. And that's what we learn from. Hashem says, may it be my will that I should change, whatever change means in His world. I should change from a pattern of justice, of measure for measure, to a pattern of behavior where I give more, where love pours out. That's what he says. So you learn from this that the activity of davening isn't asking somebody else for something that you want. He doesn't have anybody to ask. The activity of davening is changing what you are. It's changing the way you function, changing the manifestation of your spiritual energy. That's what he's doing. He's changing it from one form to a form that has much more, whatever word in English you use, rachamim. Rachamim is the root of what means the womb. What comes out of the womb. It means life. It means life energy from the center of the body. Not right, not left, but perfect balance. That's what it is. That's what he's changing. That's what he's becoming. That's what his tefillah is. So you learn from that that your davening isn't asking him for anything. On the contrary, you don't ask him for anything. You're giving. You're giving. You give yourself. That's what davening means. That is the understanding of what that meditation is. If you think about this for a moment, you'll realize that to change anything through davening, to bring something into the world that wasn't there before, the only way to do that is to change yourself. And in that proportion to which you change yourself, you bring that new reality into the world. It's automatic. If you change your personality, that one of the crude and sordid and physical things you wanted before, you don't want anymore. You want something a little bit higher. A little bit higher. As soon as you want that, you've made a change in yourself. That result is affected in the world immediately. The result is miraculous, but you know why? Because changing yourself is miraculous. If you can change the tiniest aspect of your personality, at root. That means if you can really want something that you didn't want before, if you can take something that you may have invested a lot of time and energy in, that you might have convinced yourself is true, right? You might have sunk yourself in that thing. You might not be objective at all about it anymore. You can change that. One tiny detail of that thing, for a flicker of an instant, you can change that and reach some kind of objectivity. Right? You've been involved in whatever it is that you shouldn't have been involved in, or that wasn't the ultimate, or that was a cop-out in some way, or that fed a certain part of your being that wasn't the total of what it should have been. And you can change that. That's miraculous. That's miraculous. It's miraculous as taking yourself and giving it up entirely, no matter how small the change. So if you do that miraculous event in the world, what happens is you bring down a miracle. And that's why davening is regarded as a miracle. But the amazing, the most miraculous part about it is that it's a miracle that's automatic and promised. And that's what we mean when we say there's a paradox, that when you ask for a thing, if you ask for it correctly, you'll definitely get it, but only if you don't, if it doesn't mean anything. Only if you, for your own sake and your own self, it doesn't, you could give it up. Once you could give it up, then you'll have it. The Gemara puts it this way. Very difficult idea. To focus on this paradox while you're doing it is very difficult, but this is the way the Gemara puts it. It says that when Solomon, when King Shlomo built the Beis HaMikdash, we said that all davening, all tefillah goes through that place, that dimension on earth, which is the ultimate connection. All this energy goes through there. So it says when he built it, he offered the following tefillah. Listen to this. He built the house of prayer. He built the house of tefillah. Right? David actually set it up. David said, Va'ani tefillah. I am prayer. David said, I am tefillah. That's how he described himself, and that's why he was the sweet singer. He was the one who was finally able to be the connection. Not to make the connection, to be the connection. He didn't say, I daven. He said, I am tefillah. I am davening. That's how he expressed, that's what he said he was. He was the connection. So he, of course, was the man who put together the place where it would happen. And Shlomo, his son, Shlomo means perfection, totality, he came into the world and he finally built it. When it was built, he offered the following tefillah. He said, Hashem, I request from you that this house should be a source of energy. That means tefillah should go through this house, and it should be so powerful, listen to this, that whoever asks you, this is the way he put it, it's a remarkable thing, that if any non-Jewish neshama asks you for anything through this place, through this energy, grant him what he wants. That's what he said. Even if it's not the best thing in the world for him. Even if it's not necessarily good. But I want you to manifest your power in the world, that if a non-Jew will ask you for something, you should definitely have it. If a Jew asks you, don't necessarily give it to him. You hear that? Why? What should we explain like this? For the world at large, when they daven, they should have the result. Shlomo wanted that the covet of Hashem's presence in the world should be recognized. A person will daven to Hashem and not see the result, so it might be a slight in the honor of Hashem's presence in the world. He didn't want that. So he said, Hashem, set the world up in such a way that if anybody asks you for something, show immediately that you answer. I want that to be seen in the world. But for us, your people, the ones who are closest to you, we can take it. Don't handle us that way. First you make a judgment. First we want you to judge for us if it's good for us. If it's what you really want in the world and it's what's really good for you and for us together, then give it to us. But if it's not, say no. Which means that we understand that from that time on, when a Jew stands in front of Hashem, the amazing paradox that he has to carry in his mind and his heart is this. Hashem, I want this and this and this, but I'm making an honest effort to want it for you. I may enjoy this thing and I may use it in the physical world, but I'm going to try and use it for bringing your covet into the world. That's what I want to do. If this can be done, then I want you to give me this thing. But I want you to know that if it's not what you want, it makes absolutely no difference to me, and I don't want you to give it to me. Which means the kavana in a Jew's tefillah, it has to be that you're asking Hashem to first make a judgment about whether it's really best for you, because I can't actually see that clearly. And if it is, I want you to give it to me. And if it's not, I'm asking you, please, just ignore this tefillah. That's what you mean. If you do that powerfully enough, definitely we'll give it. Because if it's used for that reason, then why shouldn't it be given? If a child comes to the father and he wants something that's good for him that he will use for the right reason, why wouldn't the father give it? Of course he'll give it to him. And that's a guarantee. But only when you first give it up. That's what it means. These are some of the ideas of the nais, what we call the miracle, the nais of tefillah. This is why it's connected to a Beis HaMikdash, which is a place of connection in the world, which is a place of 10 miracles, the whole full system of miracles, each of them connected to life energy. That no mistake in life force ever happened in that place. A place of pure connection. That's what it means that you mechaven, you direct the energy, direct your heart and intention, you direct it through that place. It's not a sentimental act of facing Jerusalem because you've got a sentimental attachment to Israel. It doesn't mean that. What it means is that you are emotionally and in the neshama
connecting yourself to the dimension that is the connection. That's what you do. And that place is a place of miracle. What you're saying is, Hashem, I want you to bring down miracle to the world. I want you to bring down something that wouldn't have been here before. Had I not asked for this, I know you wouldn't have done it. And I'm responsible for this thing. And therefore, we understand from this, when a Jew stands up to daven to Hashem, when a mother, a Jewish woman, cries over her tehillim, and she asks Hashem for what she needs in the world, or for what her family needs in the world. Or when a Jew's in trouble and he davens, when a minyan comes together, the person has to daven for everything that he wants. And what's happening is that Hashem is waiting to give that thing. In proportion to the extent to which you ask for it, he'll open the gates and he'll give it. If you don't ask, he's not going to give it. Right? It's that simple. And therefore, if you don't ask, definitely not going to get. And therefore, you're responsible. That's what we understand. That's what we began with. That a Jew is responsible for the sustenance of the world. And if a Jew doesn't do that, if he doesn't get up and ask, it's not that he's not saying a few nice and sentimental words. It's not like that at all. He's doing two things for which he's held accountable. One is he's not bringing down the energy to the world. He's allowing the world to wither. The energy that keeps the life flow of the world going is being allowed to die out. Right? And the world becomes less and less aglow with spiritual power. And not only that, he breaks down the belief in what tefillah is. He shows everybody that tefillah isn't what we thought it was and what we've always related to as. And therefore, everybody else gets weaker in this dimension. If everybody would understand this, if Jews would understand that tefillah is not just a nice custom or a sentimental communion with yourself or some kind of relaxing meditation or whatever other nonsense they say it is, if Jews would understand that it's a direct connection, it's the core of the love between a husband and wife, it's the expression of the desire that brings the relationship that bears a child in the world, so then we would be, that let that be our tefillah for this evening, that we should be able from now on to be zeichet, to make a real connection that brings down the real life force.